The most important matters in Plato's philosophy are, first, his Utopia, which was the earliest of a long series. Second, his theory of ideas, which was a pioneer attempt to deal with the still unsolved problem of universals. Third, his arguments in favor of immortality. Fourth, his cosmogony. Fifth, his conception of knowledge as reminiscence rather than perception. But before dealing with any of these topics, I shall say a few words about the circumstances of his life and the influences which determined his political and philosophical opinions. Plato was born in 428 to 7 BC, in the early years of the Peloponnesian War. He was a well-to-do aristocrat, related to various people who were concerned in the rule of the 30 tyrants. He was a young man when Athens was defeated, and he could attribute the defeat to democracy, which his social position and his family connections were likely to make him despise. He was a pupil of Socrates, for whom he had a profound affection and respect, and Socrates was put to death by the democracy. It is not therefore surprising that he should turn to Sparta for an adumbration of his ideal commonwealth. Plato possessed the art to dress up illiberal suggestions in such a way that they deceived future ages, which admired the Republic without ever becoming aware of what was involved in its proposals. It has always been correct to praise Plato, but not to understand him. This is the common fate of great men. My object is the opposite. I wish to understand him, but to treat him with as little reverence as if he were a contemporary English or American advocate of totalitarianism. The purely philosophical influences on Plato were also such as to predispose him in favor of Sparta. These influences, speaking broadly, were Pythagoras, Parmenides, Heraclitus, and Socrates. From Pythagoras, whether by way of Socrates or not, Plato derived the Orphic elements in his philosophy, the religious trend, the belief in immortality, the otherworldliness, the priestly tone, and all that is involved in the simile of the cave. Also his respect for mathematics and his intimate intermingling of intellect and mysticism. From Parmenides, he derived the belief that reality is eternal and timeless, and that on logical grounds all change must be illusory. From Heraclitus, he derived the negative doctrine that there is nothing permanent in the sensible world. This, combined with the doctrine of Parmenides, led to the conclusion that knowledge is not to be derived from the senses, but is only to be achieved by the intellect. This in turn fitted in well with Pythagoreanism. From Socrates, he probably learnt his preoccupation with ethical problems, and his tendency to seek teleological rather than mechanical explanations of the world. The good dominated his thought more than that of the pre-Socratics, and it is difficult not to attribute this fact to the influence of Socrates. How is all this connected with authoritarianism in politics? In the first place, goodness and reality being timeless, the best state will be the one which most nearly copies the heavenly model. By having a minimum of change and a maximum of static perfection, and his rulers should be those who best understand the eternal good. In the second place, Plato, like all mystics, has in his beliefs a core of certainty which is essentially incommunicable except by a way of life. The Pythagoreans had endeavored to set up a rule of the initiate, and this is, at bottom, what Plato desires. If a man is to be a good statesman, he must know the good. This he can only do by a combination of intellectual and moral discipline. If those who have not gone through this discipline are allowed a share in the government, they will inevitably corrupt it. In the third place, much education is needed to make a good ruler on Plato's principles. It seems to us unwise to have insisted on teaching geometry to the younger Dionysius, tyrant of Syracuse, in order to make him a good king, but from Plato's point of view, it was essential. He was sufficiently Pythagorean to think that without mathematics, no true wisdom is possible. This view implies an oligarchy. In the fourth place, Plato, in common with most Greek philosophers, took the view that leisure is essential to wisdom, which will therefore not be found among those who have to work for their living, but only among those who have independent means, or who are relieved by the state from anxieties as to their subsistence. This point of view is essentially aristocratic. Two general questions arise in confronting Plato with modern ideas. The first is there such a thing as wisdom? The second is, granted that there is such a thing, can any constitution be devised that will give it political power? Wisdom, in the sense supposed, would not be any kind of specialized skill, such as is possessed by the shoemaker, or the physician, or the military tactician. It must be something more generalized than this, since its possession is supposed to make a man capable of governing wisely. I think Plato would have said that it consists in knowledge of the good, and would have supplemented this definition with the Socratic doctrine that no man sins wittingly, from which it follows that whoever knows what is good does what is right. To us, such a view seems remote from reality. We should more naturally say that there are divergent interests, and that the statesman should arrive at the best available compromise. The members of a class or a nation may have a common interest, but it will usually conflict with the interests of other classes or other nations. There are no doubt some interests of mankind as a whole, but they do not suffice to determine political action. Perhaps they will do so at some future date, but certainly not so long as there are many sovereign states. And even then, the most difficult part of the pursuit of the general interest would consist in arriving at compromises among mutually hostile special interests. But even if we suppose that there is such a thing as wisdom, is there any form of constitution which will give the government to the wise? It is clear that majorities like general councils may err, and in fact have erred. Aristocracies are not always wise. Kings are often foolish. Popes, in spite of infallibility, have committed grievous errors. Would anybody advocate entrusting the government to university graduates, or even to doctors of divinity? Or to men who, having been born poor, have made great fortunes? It is clear that no legally definable selection of citizens is likely to be wiser in practice than the whole body. It might be suggested that men could be given political wisdom by a suitable training. But the question would arise, what is a suitable training? And this would turn out to be a party question. The problem of finding a collection of wise men and leaving the government to them is thus an insoluble one. That is the ultimate reason for democracy. Chapter 14. Plato's Utopia. Plato's most important dialogue, The Republic, consists broadly of three parts. The first, to near the end of Book 5, consists in the construction of an ideal commonwealth. It is the earliest of utopias. One of the conclusions arrived at is that the rulers must be philosophers. Books 6 and 7 are concerned to define the word philosopher. This discussion constitutes the second section. The third section consists of a discussion of various kinds of actual constitutions and of their merits and defects. The nominal purpose of the Republic is to define justice. But at an early stage it is decided that, since everything is easier to see in the large than in the small, it will be better to inquire what makes a just state than what makes a just individual. And since justice must be among the attributes of the best imaginable state, such a state is first delineated, and then it is decided which of its perfections is to be called justice. Let us first describe Plato's Utopia in its broad outlines, and then consider points that arise by the way. Plato begins by deciding that the citizens are to be divided into three classes: the common people, the soldiers, and the guardians. The last alone are to have political power. There are to be much fewer of them than of the other two classes. In the first instance, it seems they are to be chosen by the legislator. After that, they will usually succeed by heredity, but in exceptional cases, a promising child may be promoted from one of the inferior classes, while among the children of guardians, a child or young man who is unsatisfactory may be degraded. The main problem, as Plato perceives, is to ensure that the guardians shall carry out the intentions of the legislator. For this purpose, he has various proposals: educational, economic, biological, and religious. It is not always clear how far these proposals apply to other classes than the guardians. It is clear that some of them apply to the soldiers, but in the main, Plato is concerned only with the guardians, who are to be a class apart, like the Jesuits in old Paraguay. the ecclesiastics in the states of the Church until 1870, and the Communist Party in the USSR at the present day. The first thing to consider is education. This is divided into two parts, music and gymnastics. Each has a wider meaning than at present. Music means everything that is in the province of the muses, and gymnastics means everything concerned with physical training and fitness. Music is almost as wide as what we should call culture, and gymnastics is somewhat wider than what we call athletics. Culture is to be devoted to making men gentlemen, in the sense which, largely owing to Plato, is familiar in England. The Athens of his day was, in one respect, analogous to England in the 19th century. There was in each an aristocracy enjoying wealth and social prestige, but having no monopoly of political power. And in each, the aristocracy had to secure as much power as it could by means of impressive behavior. In Plato's Utopia, however, the aristocracy rules unchecked. Gravity, decorum, and courage seem to be the qualities mainly to be cultivated in education. There is to be a rigid censorship, from very early years, over the literature to which the young have access and the music they are allowed to hear. Mothers and nurses are to tell their children only authorized stories. Homer and Hesiod are not to be allowed for a number of reasons. First, they represent the gods as behaving badly on occasion, which is unedifying. The young must be taught that evils never come from the gods, for God is not the author of all things, but only of good things. Second, there are things in Homer and Hesiod which are calculated to make their readers fear death, whereas everything ought to be done in education to make young people willing to die in battle. Our boys must be taught to consider slavery worse than death, and therefore they must have no stories of good men weeping and wailing even for the death of friends. Third, decorum demands that there should never be loud laughter, and yet Homer speaks of inextinguishable laughter among the blessed gods. How is a schoolmaster to reprove mirth effectively, if boys can quote this passage? Fourth, there are passages in Homer praising rich feasts, and others describing the lusts of the gods. Such passages discourage temperance. Dean Inge, a true Platonist, objected to a line in the well-known hymn, "The shout of them that triumph, the song of them that feast," which occurs in a description of the joys of heaven. Then there must be no stories in which the wicked are happy or the good unhappy. The moral effect on tender minds might be most unfortunate. On all these counts, the poets are to be condemned. Plato passes on to a curious argument about the drama. The good man, he says, ought to be unwilling to imitate a bad man. Now, most plays contain villains. Therefore, the dramatist and the actor who plays the villain's part have to imitate people guilty of various crimes. Not only criminals, but women, slaves, and inferiors generally ought not to be imitated by superior men. In Greece, as in Elizabethan England, women's parts were acted by men. Plays, therefore, if permissible at all, must contain no characters except faultless male heroes of good birth. The impossibility of this is so evident that Plato decides to banish all dramatists from his city. When any of these pantomimic gentlemen, who are so clever that they can imitate anything, comes to us and makes a proposal to exhibit himself and his poetry, we will fall down and worship him as a sweet and holy and wonderful being. But we must also inform him that in our state such as he are not permitted to exist. The law will not allow them. And so when we have anointed him with myrrh and set a garland of wool upon his head, we shall send him away to another city. Next, we come to the censorship of music, in the modern sense. The Lydian and Ionian harmonies are to be forbidden, the first because it expresses sorrow, the second because it is relaxed. Only the Dorian, for courage, and the Phrygian, for temperance, are to be allowed. Permissible rhythms must be simple, and such as are expressive of a courageous and harmonious life. The training of the body is to be very austere. No one is to eat fish or meat cooked otherwise than roasted, and there must be no sauces or confectionery. People brought up on his regimen, he says, will have no need of doctors. Up to a certain age, the young are to see no ugliness or vice. but at a suitable moment they must be exposed to enchantments, both in the shape of terrors that must not terrify, and of bad pleasures that must not seduce the will. Only after they have withstood these tests will they be judged fit to be guardians. Young boys, before they are grown up, should see war, though they should not themselves fight. As for economics, Plato proposes a thoroughgoing communism for the guardians, and I think also for the soldiers, though this is not very clear. The guardians are to have small houses and simple food. They are to live as in a camp, dining together in companies. They are to have no private property beyond what is absolutely necessary. Gold and silver are to be forbidden. Though not rich, there is no reason why they should not be happy. But the purpose of the city is the good of the whole, not the happiness of one class. Both wealth and poverty are harmful, and in Plato's city neither will exist. There is a curious argument about war that it will be easy to purchase allies, since our city will not want any share in the spoils of victory. With feigned unwillingness, the Platonic Socrates proceeds to apply his communism to the family. Friends, he says, should have all things in common, including women and children. He admits that this presents difficulties, but thinks them not insuperable. First of all, girls are to have exactly the same education as boys, learning music, gymnastics, and the art of war along with the boys. Women are to have complete equality with men in all respects. The same education which makes a man a good guardian will make a woman a good guardian, for their original nature is the same. No doubt there are differences between men and women, but they have nothing to do with politics. Some women are philosophic and suitable as guardians, some are warlike and could make good soldiers. The legislator, having selected the guardians, some men and some women, will ordain that they shall all share common houses and common meals. Marriage, as we know it, will be radically transformed. Footnote: these women shall be, without exception, the common wives of these men, and no one shall have a wife of his own. End of footnote. At certain festivals, brides and bridegrooms, in such numbers as are required to keep the population constant, will be brought together, by lot, as they will be taught to believe. But in fact, the rulers of the city will manipulate the lots on eugenic principles. They will arrange that the best sires shall have the most children. All children will be taken away from their parents at birth, and great care will be taken that no parents shall know who are their children, and no children shall know who are their parents. Deformed children, and children of inferior parents, will be put away in some mysterious unknown place, as they ought to be. Children arising from unions not sanctioned by the state are to be considered illegitimate. Mothers are to be between 20 and 40, fathers between 25 and 55. Outside these ages, intercourse is to be free, but abortion or infanticide is to be compulsory. In the marriages, arranged by the state, the people concerned have no voice. They are to be actuated by the thought of their duty to the state, not by any of those common emotions that the banished poets used to celebrate. Since no one knows who his parents are, he is to call everyone father, whose age is such that he might be his father, and similarly as regards mother and brother and sister. This sort of thing happens among some savages and used to puzzle missionaries. There is to be no marriage between a father and daughter or mother and son. In general, but not absolutely, marriages of brother and sister are to be prevented. I think if Plato had thought this out more carefully, he would have found that he had prohibited all marriages, except the brother-sister marriages, which he regards as rare exceptions. It is supposed that the sentiments at present attached to the words father, mother, son, and daughter will still attach to them under Plato's new arrangements. A young man, for instance, will not strike an old man because he might be striking his father. The advantage sought is, of course, to minimize private possessive emotions and so remove obstacles to the domination of public spirit, as well as to acquiescence in the absence of private property. It was largely motives of a similar kind that led to the celibacy of the clergy. I come last to the theological aspect of the system. I am not thinking of the accepted Greek gods, but of certain myths which the government is to inculcate. Lying, Plato says explicitly, is to be a prerogative of the government, just as giving medicine is of physicians. The government, as we have already seen, is to deceive people in pretending to arrange marriages by lot, but this is not a religious matter. There is to be one royal lie, which Plato hopes may deceive the rulers, but will at any rate deceive the rest of the city. This lie is set forth in considerable detail. The most important part of it is the dogma that God has created men of three kinds: the best made of gold, the second best of silver, and the common herd of brass and iron. Those made of gold are fit to be guardians. Those made of silver should be soldiers. The others should do the manual work. Usually, but by no means always, children will belong to the same grade as their parents. When they do not, they must be promoted or degraded accordingly. It is thought hardly possible to make the present generation believe this myth, but the next and all subsequent generations can be so educated as not to doubt it. Plato is right in thinking that belief in this myth could be generated in two generations. The Japanese have been taught that the Mikado is descended from the sun goddess, and that Japan was created earlier than the rest of the world. Any university professor who, even in a learned work, throws doubt on these dogmas is dismissed for un-Japanese activities. What Plato does not seem to realize is that the compulsory acceptance of such myths is incompatible with philosophy and involves a kind of education which stunts intelligence. The definition of justice, which is the nominal goal of the whole discussion, is reached in Book 4. It consists, we are told, in everybody doing his own work and not being a busybody. The city is just when trader, auxiliary, and guardian each does his own job without interfering with that of other classes. That everybody should mind his own business is no doubt an admirable precept, but it hardly corresponds to what a modern would naturally call justice. The Greek word, so translated, corresponded to a concept which was very important in Greek thought, but for which we have no exact equivalent. It is worthwhile to recall what Anaximander said. Into that from which things take their rise, they pass away once more, as is ordained. For they make reparation and satisfaction to one another for their injustice according to the appointed time. Before philosophy began, the Greeks had a theory or feeling about the universe which may be called religious or ethical. According to this theory, every person and every thing has his or its appointed place and appointed function. This does not depend upon the fiat of Zeus, for Zeus himself is subject to the same kind of law as governs others. The theory is connected with the idea of fate or necessity. It applies emphatically to the heavenly bodies, but where there is vigor, there is a tendency to overstep just bounds, hence arises strife. Some kind of impersonal super-Olympian law punishes hubris and restores the eternal order which the aggressor sought to violate. This whole outlook, originally perhaps scarcely conscious, passed over into philosophy. It is to be found alike in cosmologies of strife, such as those of Heraclitus and Empedocles, and in monistic doctrines, such as that of Parmenides. It is the source of the belief both in natural and in human law, and it clearly underlies Plato's conception of justice. The word justice, as still used in the law, is more similar to Plato's conception than it is as used in political speculation. Under the influence of democratic theory, we have come to associate justice with equality, while for Plato it has no such implication. Justice, in the sense in which it is almost synonymous with law, as when we speak of courts of justice, is concerned mainly with property rights, which have nothing to do with equality. The first suggested definition of justice at the beginning of the Republic is that it consists in paying debts. This definition is soon abandoned as inadequate, but something of it remains at the end. There are several points to be noted about Plato's definition. First, it makes it possible to have inequalities of power and privilege without injustice. The guardians are to have all the power because they are the wisest members of the community. Injustice would only occur, on Plato's definition, if there were men in the other classes who were wiser than some of the guardians. That is why Plato provides for promotion and degradation of citizens, although he thinks that the double advantage of birth and education will in most cases make the children of guardians superior to the children of others. If there were a more exact science of government and more certainty of men following its precepts, there would be much to be said for Plato's system. No one thinks it unjust to put the best men into a football team, although they acquire thereby a great superiority. If football were managed as democratically as the Athenian government, the students to play for their university would be chosen by lot. But in matters of government, it is difficult to know who has the most skill, and very far from certain that a politician will use his skill in the public interest rather than in his own or in that of his class or party or creed. The next point is that Plato's definition of justice presupposes a state organized either on traditional lines or like his own, so as to realize in its totality some ethical ideal. Justice, we are told, consists in every man doing his own job. But what is a man's job? In a state which, like ancient Egypt or the kingdom of the Incas, remains unchanged generation after generation, a man's job is his father's job, and no question arises. But in Plato's state, no man has any legal father. His job, therefore, must be decided either by his own tastes or by the state's judgment as to his aptitudes. The latter is obviously what Plato would desire, but some kinds of work, though highly skilled, may be deemed pernicious. Plato takes this view of poetry, and I should take it of the work of Napoleon. The purposes of the government, therefore, are essential in determining what is a man's job. Although all the rulers are to be philosophers, there are to be no innovations. A philosopher is to be for all time a man who understands and agrees with Plato. When we ask, what will Plato's Republic achieve? The answer is rather humdrum. It will achieve success in wars against roughly equal populations, and it will secure a livelihood for a certain small number of people. It will almost certainly produce no art or science because of its rigidity. In this respect, as in others, it will be like Sparta. In spite of all the fine talk, skill in war and enough to eat is all that will be achieved. Plato had lived through famine and defeat in Athens. Perhaps, subconsciously, he thought the avoidance of these evils the best that statesmanship could accomplish. A utopia, if seriously intended, obviously must embody the ideals of its creator. Let us consider for a moment what we can mean by ideals. In the first place, they are desired by those who believe in them, but they are not desired quite in the same way as a man desires personal comforts, such as food and shelter. What makes the difference between an ideal and an ordinary object of desire is that the former is impersonal. It is something having, at least ostensibly, no special reference to the ego of the man who feels the desire, and therefore capable, theoretically, of being desired by everybody. Thus, we might define an ideal as something desired, not egocentric, and such that the person desiring it wishes that everyone else also desired it. I may wish that everybody had enough to eat, that everybody felt kindly towards everybody, and so on, and if I wish anything of this kind, I shall also wish others to wish it. In this way, I can build up what looks like an impersonal ethic, although in fact it rests upon the personal basis of my own desires. For the desire remains mine, even when what is desired has no reference to myself. For example, one man may wish that everybody understood science, and another that everybody appreciated art. It is a personal difference between the two men that produces this difference in their desires. The personal element becomes apparent as soon as controversy is involved. Suppose some man says, "You are wrong to wish everybody to be happy. You ought to desire the happiness of Germans and the unhappiness of everyone else." Here, "ought" may be taken to mean that that is what the speaker wishes me to desire. I might retort that, not being German, it is psychologically impossible for me to desire the unhappiness of all non-Germans, but this answer seems inadequate. Again, there may be a conflict of purely impersonal ideals. Nietzsche's hero differs from a Christian saint, yet both are impersonally admired, the one by Nietzscheans, the other by Christians. How are we to decide between the two except by means of our own desires? Yet, if there is nothing further, an ethical disagreement can only be decided by emotional appeals, or by force, in the ultimate resort, by war. On questions of fact, we can appeal to science and scientific methods of observation, but on ultimate questions of ethics, there seems to be nothing analogous. Yet, if this is really the case, ethical disputes resolve themselves into contests for power, including propaganda power. This point of view, in a crude form, is put forth in the first book of the Republic, by Thrasymachus, who, like almost all the characters in Plato's dialogues, was a real person. He was a sophist from Chalcedon, and a famous teacher of rhetoric. He appeared in the first comedy of Aristophanes, 427 BC. After Socrates has, for some time, been amiably discussing justice with an old man named Cephalus, and with Plato's elder brothers, Glaucon and Adeimantus, Thrasymachus, who has been listening with growing impatience, breaks in with a vehement protest against such childish nonsense. He proclaims emphatically that justice is nothing else than the interest of the stronger. This point of view is refuted by Socrates with quibbles. It is never fairly faced. It raises the fundamental question in ethics and politics, namely, is there any standard of good and bad except what the man using these words desires? If there is not, many of the consequences drawn by Thrasymachus seem unescapable. Yet how are we to say that there is? At this point, religion has at first sight a simple answer. God determines what is good and what bad. The man whose will is in harmony with the will of God is a good man. Yet this answer is not quite orthodox. Theologians say that God is good, and this implies that there is a standard of goodness which is independent of God's will. We are thus forced to face the question, is there objective truth or falsehood in such a statement as pleasure is good, in the same sense as in such a statement as snow is white? To answer this question, a very long discussion would be necessary. Some may think that we can, for practical purposes, evade the fundamental issue and say, I do not know what is meant by objective truth, but I shall consider a statement true if all or virtually all of those who have investigated it are agreed in upholding it. In this sense, it is true that snow is white, that Caesar was assassinated, that water is composed of hydrogen and oxygen, and so on. We are then faced with a question of fact. Are there any similarly agreed statements in ethics? If there are, they can be made the basis both for rules of private conduct and for a theory of politics. If there are not, we are driven in practice, whatever may be the philosophic truth, to a contest by force or propaganda or both, whenever an irreconcilable ethical difference exists between powerful groups. For Plato, this question does not really exist. Although his dramatic sense leads him to state the position of Thrasymachus forcibly, he is quite unaware of its strength, and allows himself to be grossly unfair in arguing against it. Plato is convinced that there is the good, and that its nature can be ascertained. When people disagree about it, one at least is making an intellectual error, just as much as if the disagreement were a scientific one on some matter of fact. The difference between Plato and Thrasymachus is very important, but for the historian of philosophy, it is one to be only noted, not decided. Plato thinks he can prove that his ideal republic is good. A democrat who accepts the objectivity of ethics may think that he can prove the republic bad, but anyone who agrees with Thrasymachus will say, there is no question of proving or disproving. The only question is whether you like the kind of state that Plato desires. If you do, it is good for you. If you do not, it is bad for you. If many do and many do not, the decision cannot be made by reason, but only by force, actual or concealed. This is one of the issues in philosophy that are still open. On each side there are men who command respect, but for a very long time the opinion that Plato advocated remained almost undisputed. It should be observed further that the view which substitutes the consensus of opinion for an objective standard has certain consequences that few would accept. What are we to say of scientific innovators like Galileo, who advocate an opinion with which few agree, but finally win the support of almost everybody. They do so by means of arguments, not by emotional appeals or state propaganda or the use of force. This implies a criterion other than the general opinion. In ethical matters, there is something analogous in the case of the great religious teachers. Christ taught that it is not wrong to pluck ears of corn on the Sabbath, but that it is wrong to hate your enemies. Such ethical innovations obviously imply some standard other than majority opinion, but the standard, whatever it is not objective fact, as in a scientific question. This problem is a difficult one, and I do not profess to be able to solve it. For the present, let us be content to note it. Plato's Republic, unlike modern utopias, was perhaps intended to be actually founded. This was not so fantastic or impossible as it might naturally seem to us. Many of its provisions, including some that we should have thought quite impracticable, were actually realized at Sparta. The rule of philosophers had been attempted by Pythagoras, and in Plato's time, Archytas the Pythagorean was politically influential in Taras, the modern Taranto, when Plato visited Sicily and southern Italy. It was a common practice for cities to employ a sage to draw up their laws. Solon had done this for Athens, and Protagoras for Thurii. Colonies in those days were completely free from control by their parent cities, and it would have been quite feasible for a band of Platonists to establish the Republic on the shores of Spain or Gaul. Unfortunately, chance led Plato to Syracuse, a great commercial city engaged in desperate wars with Carthage. In such an atmosphere, no philosopher could have achieved much. In the next generation, the rise of Macedonia had made all small states antiquated, and had brought about the futility of all political experiments in miniature. Chapter 15. The Theory of Ideas. The middle of the Republic, from the later part of Book 5 to the end of Book 7, is occupied mainly with questions of pure philosophy as opposed to politics. These questions are introduced by a somewhat abrupt statement. Until philosophers are kings, or the kings and princes of this world have the spirit and power of philosophy, and political greatness and wisdom meet in one, and those commoner natures who pursue either to the exclusion of the other are compelled to stand aside, cities will never have rest from these evils, no, nor the human race, as I believe. And then only will this our state have a possibility of life and behold the light of day. If this is true, we must decide what constitutes a philosopher, and what we mean by philosophy. The consequent discussion is the most famous part of the Republic, and has perhaps been the most influential. It has, in parts, extraordinary literary beauty. The reader may disagree, as I do, with what is said, but cannot help being moved by it. Plato's philosophy rests on the distinction between reality and appearance, which was first set forth by Parmenides. Throughout the discussion with which we are now concerned, Parmenidean phrases and arguments are constantly recurring. There is, however, a religious tone about reality, which is rather Pythagorean than Parmenidean. And there is much about mathematics and music which is directly traceable to the disciples of Pythagoras. This combination of the logic of Parmenides with the otherworldliness of Pythagoras and the Orphics produced a doctrine which was felt to be satisfying to both the intellect and the religious emotions. The result was a very powerful synthesis, which, with various modifications, influenced most of the great philosophers, down to and including Hegel. But not only philosophers were influenced by Plato. Why did the Puritans object to the music and painting and gorgeous ritual of the Catholic Church? You will find the answer in the 10th book of the Republic. Why are children in school compelled to learn arithmetic? The reasons are given in the 7th book. The following paragraphs summarize Plato's theory of ideas. Our question is, what is a philosopher? The first answer is in accordance with the etymology. A philosopher is a lover of wisdom. But this is not the same thing as a lover of knowledge, in the sense in which an inquisitive man may be said to love knowledge. Vulgar curiosity does not make a philosopher. The definition is therefore amended. The philosopher is a man who loves the vision of truth. But what is this vision? Consider a man who loves beautiful things, who makes a point of being present at new tragedies, seeing new pictures, and hearing new music. Such a man is not a philosopher because he loves only beautiful things, whereas the philosopher loves beauty in itself. The man who only loves beautiful things is dreaming, whereas the man who knows absolute beauty is wide awake. The former has only opinion, the latter has knowledge. What is the difference between knowledge and opinion? The man who has knowledge of something, that is to say, of something that exists, for what does not exist is nothing. This is reminiscent of Parmenides. Thus, knowledge is infallible, since it is logically impossible for it to be mistaken. But opinion can be mistaken. How can this be? Opinion cannot be of what is not, for that is impossible, nor of what is, for then it would be knowledge. Therefore, opinion must be of what both is and is not. But how is this possible? The answer is that particular things always partake of opposite characters. What is beautiful is also in some respects ugly. What is just is in some respects unjust, and so on. All particular sensible objects, so Plato contends, have this contradictory character. They are thus intermediate between being and not being, and are suitable as objects of opinion, but not of knowledge. But those who see the absolute and eternal and immutable may be said to know, and not to have opinion only. Thus we arrive at the conclusion that opinion is of the world presented to the senses, whereas knowledge is of a supersensible eternal world. For instance, opinion is concerned with particular beautiful things, but knowledge is concerned with beauty in itself. The only argument advanced is that it is self-contradictory to suppose that a thing can be both beautiful and not beautiful, or both just and not just, and that nevertheless particular things seem to combine such contradictory characters. Therefore, particular things are not real. Heraclitus had said, "We step and do not step into the same rivers. We are and are not." By combining this with Parmenides, we arrive at Plato's result. There is, however, something of great importance in Plato's doctrine which is not traceable to his predecessors, and that is the theory of ideas or forms. This theory is partly logical, partly metaphysical. The logical part has to do with the meaning of general words. There are many individual animals of whom we can truly say, "This is a cat." What do we mean by the word cat? Obviously, something different from each particular cat. An animal is a cat, it would seem, because it participates in a general nature common to all cats. Language cannot get on without general words such as cat, and such words are evidently not meaningless. But if the word cat means anything, it means something which is not this or that cat, but some kind of universal cattiness. This is not born when a particular cat is born, and does not die when it dies. In fact, it has no position in space or time. It is eternal. This is the logical part of the doctrine. The arguments in its favor, whether ultimately valid or not, are strong, and quite independent of the metaphysical part of the doctrine. According to the metaphysical part of the doctrine, the word cat means a certain ideal cat, the cat, created by God and unique. Particular cats partake of the nature of the cat, but more or less imperfectly. It is only owing to this imperfection that there can be many of them. The cat is real. Particular cats are only apparent. In the last book of the Republic, as a preliminary to a condemnation of painters, there is a very clear exposition of the doctrine of ideas or forms. Here Plato explains that whenever a number of individuals have a common name, they have also a common idea or form. For instance, though there are many beds, there is only one idea or form of a bed. Just as a reflection of a bed in a mirror is only apparent and not real, so the various particular beds are unreal, being only copies of the idea, which is the one real bed and is made by God. Of this one bed made by God, there can be knowledge, but in respect of the many beds made by carpenters, there can be only opinion. The philosopher, as such, will be interested only in the one ideal bed, not in the many beds found in the sensible world. He will have a certain indifference to ordinary mundane affairs. How can he who has magnificence of mind and is the spectator of all time and all existence think much of human life? The youth who is capable of becoming a philosopher will be distinguished among his fellows as just and gentle, fond of learning, possessed of a good memory, and a naturally harmonious mind. Such a one shall be educated into a philosopher and a guardian. At this point, Adeimantus breaks in with a protest. When he tries to argue with Socrates, he says, he feels himself led a little astray at each step until, in the end, all his former notions are turned upside down. But whatever Socrates may say, it remains the case, as anyone can see, that people who stick to philosophy become strange monsters, not to say utter rogues. Even the best of them are made useless by philosophy. Socrates admits that this is true in the world as it is, but maintains that it is the other people who are to blame, not the philosophers. In a wise community, the philosophers would not seem foolish. It is only among fools that the wise are judged to be destitute of wisdom. What are we to do in this dilemma? There were to have been two ways of inaugurating our republic: by philosophers becoming rulers, or by rulers becoming philosophers. The first way seems impossible as a beginning, because in a city not already philosophic, the philosophers are unpopular. But a born prince might be a philosopher, and one is enough. Let there be one man who has a city obedient to his will, and he might bring into existence the ideal polity about which the world is so incredulous. Plato hoped that he had found such a prince in the younger Dionysius, tyrant of Syracuse, but the young man turned out disappointingly. In the 6th and 7th books of the Republic, Plato is concerned with two questions. First, what is philosophy? Second, how can a young man or woman of suitable temperament be so educated as to become a philosopher? Philosophy for Plato is a kind of vision, the vision of truth. It is not purely intellectual. It is not merely wisdom, but love of wisdom. Spinoza's intellectual love of God is much the same intimate union of thought and feeling. Everyone who has done any kind of creative work has experienced, in a greater or less degree, the state of mind in which, after long labor, truth or beauty appears, or seems to appear, in a sudden glory. It may be only about some small matter, or it may be about the universe. The experience is, at the moment, very convincing. Doubt may come later, but at the time there is utter certainty. I think most of the best creative work in art, in science, in literature, and in philosophy has been the result of such a moment. Whether it comes to others as to me, I cannot say. For my part, I have found that when I wish to write a book on some subject, I must first soak myself in detail until all the separate parts of the subject matter are familiar. Then, some day, if I am fortunate, I perceive the whole, with all its parts duly interrelated. After that, I only have to write down what I have seen. The nearest analogy is first walking all over a mountain in a mist, until every path and ridge and valley is separately familiar, and then, from a distance, seeing the mountain whole and clear in bright sunshine. This experience, I believe, is necessary to good creative work, but it is not sufficient. Indeed, the subjective certainty that it brings with it may be fatally misleading. William James describes a man who got the experience from laughing gas. Whenever he was under its influence, he knew the secret of the universe, but when he came to, he had forgotten it. At last, with immense effort, he wrote down the secret before the vision had faded. When completely recovered, he rushed to see what he had written. It was, "A smell of petroleum prevails throughout." What seems like sudden insight may be misleading, and must be tested soberly when the divine intoxication has passed. Plato's vision, which he completely trusted at the time when he wrote the Republic, needs ultimately the help of a parable, the parable of the cave, in order to convey its nature to the reader. But it is led up to by various preliminary discussions designed to make the reader see the necessity of the world of ideas. First, the world of the intellect is distinguished from the world of the senses. Then intellect and sense perception are in turn each divided into two kinds. The two kinds of sense perception need not concern us. The two kinds of intellect are called, respectively, reason and understanding. Of these, reason is the higher kind. It is concerned with pure ideas, and its method is dialectic. Understanding is the kind of intellect that is used in mathematics. It is inferior to reason in that it uses hypotheses which it cannot test. In geometry, for example, we say, let ABC be a rectilinear triangle. It is against the rules to ask whether ABC really is a rectilinear triangle, although if it is a figure that we have drawn, we may be sure that it is not, because we cannot draw absolutely straight lines. Accordingly, mathematics can never tell us what is, but only what would be if. There are no straight lines in the sensible world. Therefore, if mathematics is to have more than hypothetical truth, we must find evidence for the existence of supersensible straight lines in a supersensible world. This cannot be done by the understanding, but according to Plato, it can be done by reason, which shows that there is a rectilinear triangle in heaven, of which geometrical propositions can be affirmed categorically, not hypothetically. There is at this point a difficulty which seems to have escaped Plato's notice, although it was evident to modern idealistic philosophers. We saw that God made only one bed, and it would be natural to suppose that he made only one straight line. But if there is a heavenly triangle, he must have made at least three straight lines. The objects of geometry, though ideal, must exist in many examples. We need the possibility of two intersecting circles, and so on. This suggests that geometry, on Plato's theory, should not be capable of ultimate truth, but should be condemned as part of the study of appearance. We will, however, ignore this point. Plato seeks to explain the difference between clear intellectual vision and the confused vision of sense perception by an analogy from the sense of sight. Sight, he says, differs from the other senses, since it requires not only the eye and the object, but also light. We see clearly objects on which the sun shines. In twilight, we see confusedly, and in pitch darkness, not at all. Now, the world of ideas is what we see when the object is illumined by the sun, while the world of passing things is a confused twilight world. The eye is compared to the soul, and the sun as the source of light to truth or goodness. The soul is like an eye, when resting upon that on which truth and being shine. The soul perceives and understands, and is radiant with intelligence. But when turned towards the twilight of becoming and perishing, then she has opinion only, and goes blinking about, and is first of one opinion, and then of another, and seems to have no intelligence. Now, what imparts truth to the known, and the power of knowing to the knower, is what I would have you term the idea of good, and this you will deem to be the cause of science. This leads up to the famous simile of the cave or den, according to which those who are destitute of philosophy may be compared to prisoners in a cave, who are only able to look in one direction because they are bound, and who have a fire behind them and a wall in front. Between them and the wall there is nothing. All that they see are shadows of themselves and of objects behind them cast on the wall by the light of the fire. Inevitably, they regard these shadows as real, and have no notion of the objects to which they are due. At last, some man succeeds in escaping from the cave to the light of the sun. For the first time, he sees real things, and becomes aware that he had hitherto been deceived by shadows. If he is the sort of philosopher who is fit to become a guardian, he will feel it is his duty to those who were formerly his fellow prisoners to go down again into the cave, instruct them as to the truth, and show them the way up. But he will have difficulty in persuading them because, coming out of the sunlight, he will see shadows less clearly than they do, and will seem to them stupider than before his escape. And now, I said, let me show in a figure how far our nature is enlightened or unenlightened. Behold, human beings living in an underground den, which has a mouth open toward the light and reaching all along the den, here they have been from their childhood, and have their legs and necks chained so that they cannot move, and can only see before them, being prevented by the chains from turning round their heads. Above and behind them a fire is blazing at a distance, and between the fire and the prisoners there is a raised way. And you will see, if you look, a low wall built along the way, like the screen which marionette players have in front of them, over which they show the puppets. I see. And do you see, I said, men passing along the wall, carrying all sorts of vessels and statues and figures of animals made of wood and stone and various materials which appear over the wall. Some of them are talking, others silent. You have shown me a strange image, and they are strange prisoners. Like ourselves, I replied, and they see only their own shadows, or the shadows of one another, which the fire throws on the opposite wall of the cave. The position of the good in Plato's philosophy is peculiar. Science and truth, he says, are like the good, but the good has a higher place. The good is not essence, but far exceeds essence in dignity and power. Dialectic leads to the end of the intellectual world in the perception of the absolute good. It is by means of the good that dialectic is able to dispense with the hypotheses of the mathematician. The underlying assumption is that reality, as opposed to appearance, is completely and perfectly good. To perceive the good, therefore, is to perceive reality. Throughout Plato's philosophy, there is the same fusion of intellect and mysticism as in Pythagoreanism, but at this final culmination, mysticism clearly has the upper hand. Plato's doctrine of ideas contains a number of obvious errors, but in spite of these, it marks a very important advance in philosophy. Since it is the first theory to emphasize the problem of universals, which in varying forms has persisted to the present day, beginnings are apt to be crude, but their originality should not be overlooked on this account. Something remains of what Plato had to say even after all necessary corrections have been made. The absolute minimum of what remains, even in the view of those most hostile to Plato, is this: that we cannot express ourselves in a language composed wholly of proper names, but must have also general words such as man, dog, cat. Or if not these, then relational words such as similar, before, and so on. Such words are not meaningless noises, and it is difficult to see how they can have meaning if the world consists entirely of particular things, such as are designated by proper names. There may be ways of getting round this argument, but at any rate, it affords a prima facie case in favor of universals. I shall provisionally accept it as in some degree valid, but when so much is granted, the rest of what Plato says by no means follows. In the first place, Plato has no understanding of philosophical syntax. I can say, Socrates is human, Plato is human, and so on. In all these statements, it may be assumed that the word human has exactly the same meaning. But whatever it means something which is not of the same kind as Socrates, Plato, and the rest of the individuals who compose the human race. Human is an adjective. It would be nonsense to say human is human. Plato makes a mistake analogous to saying human is human. He thinks that beauty is beautiful. He thinks that the universal man is the name of a pattern man created by God, of whom actual men are imperfect and somewhat unreal copies. He fails altogether to realize how great is the gap between universals and particulars. His ideas are really just other particulars, ethically and aesthetically superior to the ordinary kind. He himself, at a later date, began to see this difficulty, as appears in the Parmenides, which contains one of the most remarkable cases in history of self-criticism by a philosopher. The Parmenides is supposed to be related by Antiphon, Plato's half-brother, who alone remembers the conversation, but is now only interested in horses. They find him carrying a bridle, and with difficulty persuade him to relate the famous discussion between Parmenides, Zeno, and Socrates. This, we are told, took place when Parmenides was old, about 65, Zeno in middle life, about 40, and Socrates quite a young man. Socrates expounds the theory of ideas. He is sure that there are ideas of likeness, justice, beauty, and goodness. He is not sure that there is an idea of man, and he rejects with indignation the suggestion that there could be ideas of such things as hair and mud and dirt. Though, he adds, there are times when he thinks that there is nothing without an idea. He runs away from this view because he is afraid of falling into a bottomless pit of nonsense. Yes, Socrates, says Parmenides, that is because you are still young. The time will come, if I am not mistaken, when philosophy will have a firmer grasp of you, and then you will not despise even the meanest things. Socrates agrees that in his view there are certain ideas of which all other things partake, and from which they derive their names, that similars, for example, become similar because they partake of similarity, and great things become great because they partake of greatness, and that just and beautiful things become just and beautiful because they partake of justice and beauty. Parmenides proceeds to raise difficulties. A. Does the individual partake of the whole idea, or only of a part? To either view there are objections. If the former, one thing is in many places at once. If the latter, the idea is divisible, and a thing which has a part of smallness will be smaller than absolute smallness, which is absurd. B. When an individual partakes of an idea, the individual and the idea are similar. Therefore there will have to be another idea, embracing both the particulars and the original idea. And there will have to be yet another, embracing the particulars and the two ideas, and so on ad infinitum. Thus, every idea, instead of being one, becomes an infinite series of ideas. This is the same as Aristotle's argument of the third man. C. Socrates suggests that perhaps ideas are only thoughts, but Parmenides points out that thoughts must be of something. D. Ideas cannot resemble the particulars that partake of them for the reason given in B above. E. Ideas, if there are any, must be unknown to us because our knowledge is not absolute. F. If God's knowledge is absolute, he will not know us and therefore cannot rule us. Nevertheless, the theory of ideas is not wholly abandoned. Without ideas, Socrates says, there will be nothing on which the mind can rest, and therefore reasoning will be destroyed. Parmenides tells him that his troubles come of lack of previous training, but no definite conclusion is reached. I do not think that Plato's logical objections to the reality of sensible particulars will bear examination. He says, for example, that whatever is beautiful is also in some respect ugly, what is double is also half, and so on. But when we say of some work of art that it is beautiful in some respects and ugly in others, analysis will always, at least theoretically, enable us to say this part or aspect is beautiful while that part or aspect is ugly. And as regards double and half, these are relative terms. There is no contradiction in the fact that two is double of one and half of four. Plato is perpetually getting into trouble through not understanding relative terms. He thinks that if A is greater than B and less than C, then A is at once great and small, which seems to him a contradiction. Such troubles are among the infantile diseases of philosophy. The distinction between reality and appearance cannot have the consequences attributed to it by Parmenides and Plato and Hegel. If appearance really appears, it is not nothing, and is therefore part of reality. This is an argument of the correct Parmenidean sort. If appearance does not really appear, why trouble our heads about it? But perhaps someone will say, appearance does not really appear, but it appears to appear. This will not help, for we shall ask again, does it really appear to appear, or only apparently appear to appear? Sooner or later, if appearance is even to appear to appear, we must reach something that really appears, and is therefore part of reality. Plato would not dream of denying that there appear to be many beds, although there is only one real bed, namely the one made by God. But he does not seem to have faced the implications of the fact that there are many appearances, and that this many-ness is part of reality. Any attempt to divide the world into portions, of which one is more real than the other, is doomed to failure. Connected with this is another curious view of Plato's, that knowledge and opinion must be concerned with different subject matters. We should say, if I think it is going to snow, that is opinion. If later I see it snowing, that is knowledge. But the subject matter is the same on both occasions. Plato, however, thinks that what can at any time be a matter of opinion can never be a matter of knowledge. Knowledge is certain and infallible. Opinion is not merely fallible, but is necessarily mistaken, since it assumes the reality of what is only appearance. All this repeats what has been said by Parmenides. There is one respect in which Plato's metaphysic is apparently different from that of Parmenides. For Parmenides, there is only the one. For Plato, there are many ideas. There are not only beauty, truth, and goodness, but, as we saw, there is the heavenly bed, created by God. There is a heavenly man, a heavenly dog, a heavenly cat, and so on through a whole Noah's Ark. All this, however, seems in the Republic to have not been adequately thought out. A Platonic idea or form is not a thought, though it may be the object of a thought. It is difficult to see how God can have created it, since its being is timeless, and he could not have decided to create a bed unless his thought, when he decided, had had for its object that very Platonic bed which we are told he brought into existence. What is timeless must be uncreated. We come here to a difficulty which has troubled many philosophic theologians. Only the contingent world, the world in space and time, can have been created. But this is the everyday world which has been condemned as illusory and also bad. Therefore the Creator, it would seem, created only illusion and evil. Some Gnostics were so consistent as to adopt this view, but in Plato the difficulty is still below the surface, and he seems, in the Republic, to have never become aware of it. The philosopher who is to be a guardian must, according to Plato, return into the cave and live among those who have never seen the Son of Truth. It would seem that God himself, if he wishes to amend his creation, must do likewise. A Christian Platonist might so interpret the Incarnation. But it remains completely impossible to explain why God was not content with the world of ideas. The philosopher finds the cave in existence and is actuated by benevolence in returning to it. But the Creator, if he created everything, might, one would think, have avoided the cave altogether. Perhaps this difficulty arises only from the Christian notion of a Creator and is not chargeable to Plato, who says that God did not create everything, but only what is good. The multiplicity of the sensible world, on this view, would have some other source than God. And the ideas would, perhaps, be not so much created by God as constituents of his essence. The apparent pluralism involved in the multiplicity of ideas would thus not be ultimate. Ultimately, there is only God, or the good, to whom the ideas are adjectival. This, at any rate, is a possible interpretation of Plato. Plato proceeds to an interesting sketch of the education proper to a young man who is to be a guardian. We saw that the young man is selected for this honor on the ground of a combination of intellectual and moral qualities. He must be just and gentle, fond of learning, with a good memory and a harmonious mind. The young man who has been chosen for these merits will spend the years from 20 to 30 on the four Pythagorean studies: arithmetic, geometry, plain and solid, astronomy, and harmony. These studies are not to be pursued in any utilitarian spirit, but in order to prepare his mind for the vision of eternal things. In astronomy, for example, he is not to trouble himself too much about the actual heavenly bodies, but rather with the mathematics of the motion of ideal heavenly bodies. This may sound absurd to modern ears, but strange to say, it proved to be a fruitful point of view in connection with empirical astronomy. The way this came about is curious and worth considering. The apparent motions of the planets, until they have been very profoundly analyzed, appear to be irregular and complicated, and not at all such as a Pythagorean creator would have chosen. It was obvious to every Greek that the heavens ought to exemplify mathematical beauty, which would only be the case if the planets moved in circles. This would be especially evident to Plato, owing to his emphasis on the good. The problem thus arose: is there any hypothesis which will reduce the apparent disorderliness of planetary motions to order and beauty and simplicity? If there is, the idea of the good will justify us in asserting this hypothesis. Aristarchus of Samos found such a hypothesis, that all the planets, including the Earth, go round the Sun in circles. This view was rejected for 2,000 years, partly on the authority of Aristotle, who attributes a rather similar hypothesis to the Pythagoreans, De Coelo 293a. It was revived by Copernicus, and its success might seem to justify Plato's aesthetic bias in astronomy. Unfortunately, however, Kepler discovered that the planets move in ellipses, not in circles, with the Sun at a focus, not at the center. Then Newton discovered that they do not move even in exact ellipses, and so the geometrical simplicity sought by Plato and apparently found by Aristarchus of Samos proved in the end illusory. This piece of scientific history illustrates a general maxim that any hypothesis, however absurd, may be useful in science if it enables a discoverer to conceive things in a new way, but that when it has served this purpose by luck, it is likely to become an obstacle to further advance. The belief in the good as the key to the scientific understanding of the world was useful at a certain stage in astronomy, but at every later stage it was harmful. The ethical and aesthetic bias of Plato, and still more of Aristotle, did much to kill Greek science. It is noteworthy that modern Platonists, almost without exception, are ignorant of mathematics, in spite of the immense importance that Plato attached to arithmetic and geometry, and the immense influence that they had on his philosophy. This is an example of the evils of specialization. A man must not write on Plato unless he has spent so much of his youth on Greek as to have had no time for the things that Plato thought important. Chapter 16. Plato's Theory of Immortality. The dialogue called after Phaedo is interesting in several respects. It purports to describe the last moments in the life of Socrates, his conversation immediately before drinking the hemlock, and after until he loses consciousness. This presents Plato's ideal of a man who is both wise and good in the highest degree, and who is totally without fear of death. Socrates, in face of death, as represented by Plato, was important ethically, both in ancient and in modern times. What the gospel account of the Passion and the Crucifixion was for Christians, the Phaedo was for pagan or free-thinking philosophers. Footnote. Even for many Christians, it is second only to the death of Christ. There is nothing in any tragedy, ancient or modern, nothing in poetry or history, with one exception, like the last hours of Socrates in Plato. These are the words of the Reverend Benjamin Jowett. End of footnote. But the imperturbability of Socrates in his last hour is bound up with his belief in immortality, and the Phaedo is important as setting forth not only the death of a martyr, but also many doctrines which were afterwards Christian. The theology of St. Paul and of the Fathers was largely derived from it, directly or indirectly, and can hardly be understood if Plato is ignored. An earlier dialogue, the Crito, tells how certain friends and disciples of Socrates arranged a plan by which he could escape to Thessaly. Probably the Athenian authorities would have been quite glad if he had escaped,